As I said, we are picking up this morning with Joseph. And as I studied last week, and really last night as I'm getting this lesson finalized and ready to go, I realized there's no way I'm getting through Joseph today. There's just no way. So I'm not even going to try. My wife said, take a deep breath, go slowly, because as Brother Lewis points out to me, very often I go too fast. And I don't want to try and speed up too fast where you all do not enjoy the study for sure. But there's a lot with regard to Joseph that needs to be looked at. And I think that we need to be refreshed as we look at his wonderful story of faith in the Old Testament. I think he is one of these stories that I look at as being one of the most enjoyable and one of the most applicable even to the life that I live on this earth. Why? Well, not because I'm worried about being some governor over a massive state of Egypt. Not because we are in threat of huge famine in the land, but because I think his faithful story shows us that the trials and tribulations that someone might go through can still allow us to remain faithful to God throughout all those tribulations, throughout all those troubles that you do and that you have in life. And in the face of temptation, that you can look that temptation square in the face and say no and run from it. How can that not be applicable to us in our lives? I mean, I don't see how it can't be, because we face it each and every day. One of those two situations we probably have on a daily basis, whether it's staring temptation right down in the face or dealing with the trials, tribulations, and troubles of our physical life. And I think the story of Joseph speaks volumes to us about what a faithful man can be commended for after going through so great of temptations and trials in his life. Look in Hebrews chapter 11, verse 22. And Joey, I'm not sure what's going on, but it's not showing on the screen. So if you would, is it my fault or yours? Let me see. Hold on. My fault. Okay, I got it. I can't see it on the screen, though. Okay, here we go. Now, chapter 11, verse 22 commends Joseph right after commending Jacob for his faith. And if you see Joseph here, chapter verse 22 says, by faith Joseph, when he was dying, made mention of the exodus of the sons of Israel and gave orders concerning his bones. We're going to get to this application of Joseph's faith later on in the lesson. This is not what I want to focus on as his death. I mean, it's just kind of like the Hebrew writer here jumps right through a lot of his life and goes right to what happened at the point of death in Joseph. And it's very important. If you look at that, you see how Joseph's faith resounds even in his death there at the end of his life, showing that he truly does believe in God and believes in the promises of God by the things that he says and gets his brothers to promise him with regard to his body. But I think it's important for us to look at Joseph and who he is, what he went through in order to get to that point in his life, get to the point of the end of his life where there he is commended for having faith at the point whenever he died. And so what I want to do is quickly go through Joseph. Well, I say quickly. I want to go through Joseph's life and us look at the story of Joseph and see some of the marvelous and miraculous points, I think, that can be applied to us in our Christian lives as well. Real quickly, who is Joseph? Now, first of all, we see a family history. As I've done almost for each one of these characters, I like to go through the family history. It tells us a lot about a person, and in Joseph, we can elaborate much more probably than others with regard to family history because we see a lot of facts about Joseph that are elaborated on throughout the latter part of the book of Genesis. As we said last week and the week before, Jacob was the father of Joseph. And Joseph, in this case, was the son of Jacob and his wife, Rachel. I'm not going to get into too much discussion on that situation because we talked about it for the last 2 weeks. If you want a copy of those lessons, I'll be glad to get them to you. But the bottom line is here is he comes from the lineage of promise through Abraham, through Isaac, and then through his father, Jacob, who married Rachel. Joseph was the firstborn son of Rachel, not the firstborn son of Jacob, but of Rachel. Rachel had wished and hoped and prayed to God for a child. She wanted to give Jacob a son. And in fact, if you look there in the verses in the scripture that I put on the screen, Genesis chapter 30, verses 23 through 24, Joseph is the child of that promise and is a child of blessing that is born to Rachel and Jacob, fulfilling that that prayer from Rachel to be able to give Jacob a child and give him a son. She, of course, had felt spurned. She felt forsaken to a certain extent because all the other women that Jacob had, being her sister Leah, her handmaid Bilhah, and Leah's handmaid Zilpah, had all given Jacob sons. Rachel was the only one who had not. So later on in life, and as a matter of fact, as we go through the scriptures in today's lesson, you'll see that Joseph is kind of called the child, the son of Jacob's old age. And so later on in life, when Jacob is older, they do have a child. They finally have this son, and it becomes this blessing for him. Of course, you see, it's not only a child of blessing for Rachel, it's also a child of blessing for Jacob as well, because this becomes his favorite son. And as you look through the rest of the scriptures, as we get to shortly, you will see he is the one who is loved by his father. Joseph is loved far more than the other brothers. That spurns jealousy, that brings on hatred toward him because of those things. But Joseph is one who is loved more than others. But he's also the son of blessing and of promise that we see over in Genesis chapter 49 when Jacob gives the blessings to all of his sons. He bestows and heaps upon blessing on Joseph. And in fact, as we talked about last week, as we talked about Jacob blessing Ephraim and Manasseh, Joseph and his blessing receives a double portion of the blessings from Jacob, very unlike the traditions of the Hebrew world. The oldest would have gotten a double portion. Well, not so in this case. Joseph received the double portion through his two sons because they were adopted and blessed by Jacob. And so Joseph was able to have those things. So Joseph became a promise not only to his mom, Rachel, but also to his father, Jacob, as we see through the scriptures. Also, Joseph is the brother to 11 brothers and one sister. If you look through the passages, this is the only sister that I could find mentioned. I may have missed one. I was trying to read 25 chapters and try and throw it all together in one lesson, so I may have missed some of the genealogy there, or maybe a mentioning of a sister. It's definitely no prominent mentioning of a sister. Even Dinah, his sister that I'm mentioning here, is not really a prominent figure of the Old Testament or Hebrew history. She is important and interesting because of Simon and Levi, or Simeon and Levi, are the ones who went and actually attacked and killed those who had raped Dinah. That's important for the passing of down of the eldership of the 12 tribes, because Reuben had already been disinherited for that position. And then Simeon and Levi had also been scorned by Jacob and said, because you have done this, you will not be a place of prominence. Judah became the tribe and the son that had the promise. And we know as you look, trace the genealogy of Christ, that is indeed the genealogy and the lineage that Christ came through. So Judah became prominent because of Dinah, but we have no interest or no really any kind of insight as to the relationship between Joseph and Dinah. Dinah is mentioned in that one episode, and that's pretty much it. And so there's no other really mentioning of the sister. However, there's lots that is mentioned about the 11 brothers. So on the flip side of the coin, you got a sister who's not really mentioned, possibly because historically the women weren't as important in Hebrew history. You know, you trace lineage through the fathers, so maybe that's why Dinah wasn't mentioned. But if you look at the other 11 brothers, there are volumes upon volumes mentioned about each brother and their descendants and lineage through the years. And what we see coming through with regard to his relationship with his other brothers is a story, I think, that's a very interesting story. It's a story that many of us have heard before. Many of us have probably heard since we were children the story of Joseph being sold into slavery. But I think it ultimately becomes a true story of true brotherly love and forgiveness in the end. Because you see, the heart of Joseph in the end becomes a man who is very similar to God, who is able and willing to forgive in the midst of all the things that he has been put through. Being able to look past all the problems, all the troubles that his brother caused him, that his brothers caused him, and look past that, and not only love them, not only forgive them, but also provide for them in their time of need. And so what you see, the story of Joseph and his brothers, of course, is first of all, he was hated by his brothers. As I alluded to a moment ago, Genesis chapter 37 starts chronicling the story of Joseph, really. Of course, he was born, and that's told earlier. But really, chapter 37 is when we really start picking up with regard to Joseph and how his life starts unfolding with his 12 brothers. And what we see in chapter 37 of Genesis is that Joseph is, of course, the favored son, of Jacob. And there we see in the first part of the chapter there, verse 3, Israel loved Joseph more than all his sons because he was a son in his old age, and he made him a multicolored or varicolored tunic. So we know, we've heard Joseph in the multicolored dream coat and all kinds of other phrases used to talk about this coat that was made for him by his father. Jacob loved his son Joseph so much. He favored him, he put him aside, he exalted him among the others, and he made him this special coat. Well, this didn't sit well with the other brothers, of course. The other 11 brothers looked down on him, scorned him, and in verse 4 it says his brothers saw that their father loved him more than all the other brothers, and so they hated him and could not speak to him on friendly terms. I mean, you're talking about some sibling rivalry here. This escalates much further than that point of Jacob and Esau that we saw in our previous lessons. This is 11 verses 1 and a hated relationship between brothers. Why? Because the brother loved, or because the brother, one brother, Joseph, was loved more by the father. Now, I don't know really why Jacob let this be seen so much. You know, I only have one child, so obviously I don't have to worry about picking favorites at this point. I hope I never pick favorites. I don't intend on ever picking favorites when we have more than one child. But, you know, I've heard before there are some families where you have a child that may be kind of favored more than the other. But I don't think that the parents flaunt that. You know, even though you may have a mother who cares for the son or a daughter more than, or kind of pulls toward them maybe. Maybe it's just a feeling of more closeness to them. It's not really a favoritism. But in this case, we have an outright favoritism by the father to one of the sons. And I think that that is something that evidently the brothers caught on to. It wasn't anything that was hidden from them. And in fact, it was something that caused them more problems than any kind of solutions with regard to the relationship they had, because his brothers hated him. And it doesn't just say that in one verse. It actually says that in verse 4. It says that in verse 5. And then it says it again in verse 8. Now, hate is a strong word. Hate is a strong word. I've told Monica that's one of the words I don't want Marley to learn when she grows up. I don't want her to learn the word hate. I don't want her to say I hate anything, because that's a very strong word. Nobody needs to hate anything. But you know, the brothers here hated their brother. Very strong word. And in fact, what you see is the escalation of that hate, that jealousy, to the next point in Joseph's troubled history and troubled past, is that they decided that instead, that they first thought they were going to kill him. You read over and flip over to chapter verse 18. They saw Joseph coming from a distance, and what does it say? They plotted against him to put him to death. The brothers wanted to kill their brother. They wanted to kill Joseph. And if it had not been for Reuben in this situation, in these circumstances, there in verse 21, when he heard his brothers trying to plot this and said, hey, how does it profit, you know, let's not take his life. He goes on there to try and persuade them just to throw him in a pit. He was planning on, as you read the scriptures, planning on coming back and getting Joseph later on, but the other brothers sold him into slavery before he would be able to do that. Now, you have a hatred by the brothers, a jealousy by the brothers, but that escalates to the point where they take their brother, they strip him of this multi-varicolored tunic, throw him in a pit, and they see this caravan coming. They decide, you know, we're just going to sell him into slavery. We're going to get something out of it, is really what Judah kind of says. What profit is it for us, in verse 26, to kill our brother and come cover up his blood? Come, let us sell him to the Ishmaelites and not lay our hands on him, for he is our brother, our own flesh, and his brothers listen to him. It's kind of like, hey, you know, this is our brother we're talking about. You know, I don't know if he had a twinge of guilt with regard to taking his own brother's life, but he thought, hey, let's get something out of this. Let's not take his life. Let's not shed his blood. He is our brother after all. Let's go sell him into slavery to the Ishmaelites as they caravan through the land. And that's what they did. And so, now who would have known? Now, who knows what would have happened had Reuben and had Judah not spoken up? They could have killed Joseph. They could have put him to death. And so you see the escalation there of this anger, this hatred, this jealousy, and what it does to somebody, especially the brothers here in this passage. But later on, what we see is the relationship between Joseph and his brothers is not always a bad relationship. Joseph first sees his brothers again, and obviously I'm skipping over some of this because I want to come back to some of the story. But what you see is the relationship between Joseph and his brothers in the latter parts of Genesis whenever he first is able to confront them and brought back to him. And it says there that Joseph treated his brothers harshly. There in chapter 42, verse 7, it says, Joseph saw his brothers. He recognized them, but he disguised himself to them and spoke to them harshly. And that's when he started kind of talking down to them, saying, why have you come here? He ends up keeping one of the brothers, Simeon, there before as kind of a guarantee that they're going to come back with their youngest brother. These brothers, I'm not sure, were all too smart because some of them probably could have questioned a few things and thought, why is he questioning us about our father so much? He's not even here. Why is he questioning about a younger brother? Because, you know, how is that important to our exchange here at hand? And it really didn't catch on to them. It never caught on to them. And so they actually left. They had to go back. As you know, the short story, the short version is they had to go back to their land. They could not come back and get Simeon back unless they brought Benjamin with them. And of course, they got home and Jacob said, I don't think so. You ain't taking Benjamin with you. And so they end up staying. They don't go back right away. They stay until they ran out of the grain and the preserves that they had gotten before in their first trip to Egypt. And when they finally ran out, Jacob said, hey, you need to go back to Egypt. They're the only ones who've got any kind of food for us. Go get some grain, get some provisions for us. And they said, hey, we're not going back, Dad, unless you let us take Benjamin with us, because he told us not to come back without Benjamin. He'll kill us. And so we're not going to go. And so they finally relent, allow Benjamin to go back. And of course, that snowballs into the reconciliation between Joseph and his family. If you look in this passage in chapter 42, with Joseph first confronting his brothers, I kind of wonder what's going through his mind. I tend to believe that at this point, when he treats them harshly, he was shocked and surprised to see his brothers show up there in the land of Egypt. I don't think he expected them to show up there in the land. I think that he did know that there was a famine and there would be a need from all around the world. It says all the world was under this famine. So I don't think that he was necessarily naive in thinking. I just think that he didn't think that it would come down to them. Nor did he really, I don't think through the whole process that he would be the one to determine whether his brothers and their families would receive any support or sustenance if they were to come. So they kind of showed up there on the doorstep, and he's kind of shocked. He hides himself. He disguises himself so they don't know who he is. I don't really know how that happened. I guess he maybe had some kind of cloth or clothing around him where they weren't able to recognize him. I'm sure it's been many years later, as we see. It's about at least 30 years, we know, because he was 30 years when he took that position as governor. So, it's, you know, he's several years older for sure than he was, but they didn't recognize him. But he dealt harshly with them. I don't think it was because of bitterness or any kind of an attitude of revenge whatsoever. I think he was almost playing a part here to make sure that his goal of seeing his father and his younger brother was attained. And so you see him dealing harshly with his brothers here. I don't believe it was because of revenge or any kind of ulterior motive at this point. Because as you read and go throughout the story, you see the total reconciliation at the end when Joseph forgives his brothers. There's no harsh feelings there. Why? Because Joseph sees the bigger and larger picture in the end. And so you look and flip over if you want to in chapter 45, and you see the ultimate reconciliation between all the brothers. They come that second time, as I said, with their youngest brother, Benjamin. And when they come at that point, Joseph says in verse 45, verse 1, he couldn't control himself and around for all those who stood by him, and he cried, you know, have everyone go out from me. So all the Egyptians left his chambers, all the Egyptians left him there with the brothers, and there was no man with him when Joseph made himself known to his brothers. And at that point in verse 2, it says he wept so loudly that the Egyptians heard it and the household of Pharaoh heard it. And so Joseph said to his brothers, I am Joseph. Is my father still alive? But his brothers could not answer him, for they were dismayed at his presence. I love the word dismayed in this passage. You know, you kind of think, what were these brothers thinking at this point? I think they probably were thinking several things, probably depending on which brother it was. Some were probably thinking, oh no, he's going to get us now. Some possibly were dismayed because they had suffered the anguish and torment for all these years of the thought that they had put their brother out. And they were the ones who were responsible for his death or for his destruction or for his enslavement in some other foreign land. And so the dismay that you see here with regard to the I think the brothers here, Could be also even maybe they thought they saw a ghost. You know, that kind of a sense of, you know, we thought you were dead. You know, and here's someone who's alive and well and doing very well for himself. And here they look at their brother and they are dismayed. So I think you can kind of take this word. It's not a very concrete meaning at all, but they were dismayed. Obviously, they weren't ecstatically happy. Okay, that would have said they were happy there, I think, if they were ecstatically overjoyed and overcome with emotion. They didn't weep either, you know, so you see that there wasn't that kind of an emotional response that Joseph even had. This man, imagine the governor of all the land of Egypt. This man is second only to Pharaoh, weeping so loudly that the whole household where he was heard him. This man was distraught emotionally because he finally was able to tell his brothers he was alive. And to let them know that everything is okay. Because that's what he does. If you see in the latter parts here. Verse 4. Obviously Joseph knew. My brothers really aren't taking this too well. I'm not sure, you know, I don't know what they're thinking. He tries to reassure him. He says, please come closer to me. They come closer and says, I'm your brother Joseph who you sold into Egypt. And now do not be grieved or angry with yourselves because you sold me here. For God sent me before you to preserve life. For the famine has been in the land these 2 years. And there are still 5 years in which there will be another plowing, neither plowing nor harvesting. By the way, a side note here, that would have made Joseph approximately 39 years old at this point in time. Because you got 7 years of plenty, then there were 2 years of a famine, so that's going to be 9 added on to 30 years that he took office at. So he's approximately 39 years old whenever he's finally reunited with his brothers. Verse 7, though, I think, yeah. Before he went where? Yes, he was 30 when he was placed in the office by Pharaoh. If you look over with me in chapter 41, verse 46, it says Joseph was 30 years old when he stood before Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and he went out in the presence and went through all the land of Egypt. That's when he first took office as the governor of Egypt. Then, of course, numerically, and I'm an accounting major, but yet I haven't worked with numbers in years. But if you look, you got 7 years of plenty, which has already passed. And then it says here that the famine has been in the land for 2 years, is what Joseph tells his brothers. So that's 39 years old. So I would say approximately 39 years of age is about what Joseph is at this point. The key verse, though, I think, with his speech to his brothers is verse 7. God sent me before you to preserve for you a remnant in the earth and to keep you alive by great deliverance. Now, therefore, it was not you who sent me here, but God. And he has made me a father to Pharaoh and lord of all his household and ruler over all the land of Egypt. And, of course, at that point, he says, go get father. Y'all come back and you stay with us in the land of Goshen in Egypt. So I will care for you. We will take care of you. You will have all that you need so that you and your families will be taken care of for these remaining 5 years of famine. So Joseph here comes to his brothers and not only tells them not to worry, not to be concerned, or not to be distraught. He tells them, hey, it's not even your fault in the end. I don't blame you, is what he says. I look at it as being God's hand being on me as I went throughout all these troubles, as I went throughout all these trials in my life. I mean, I don't think he's necessarily just erasing all responsibility from the brothers, but I think he's reassuring them that, hey, God has bigger plans that we didn't know about. He was able to tell them and convey to them, hey, don't beat yourselves up for what you did to me. Because in the end, it's really God's purpose behind it all that allowed me to be able to be in the place that I am, to be able to provide for you. And in the end, that's exactly what happened. Joseph provided for them. Their families lived together there in the land of Goshen. They prospered together. So much to the point, as you read the latter part of Genesis, here it says in chapter 47, if you flip over there with me, this is kind of a foreshadowing of things to come over in the first part of Exodus. Chapter 47 in verses 27 through 28, it says, Israel lived in the land of Egypt in Goshen, and they acquired property in it and were fruitful and became very numerous. And Jacob lived in the land of Egypt 17 years, so the length of Jacob's life was 147 years. Jacob lived there, and those 17 years they lived in the land of Egypt, the nation of Israel became a nation, became a mighty multitude of people. The brethren, those brothers were able, and their families multiplied, became very numerous. if you know the story of Exodus, you know that's really what precipitated the enslavement of the Israel people, because they became so numerous that Pharaoh, the new Pharaoh who did not know Joseph, was worried about Israel taking over their people. And but what we see is the prosperity of this people was accomplished. Why? Because Joseph looked after them. Joseph was able to arrange for them to be able to live peaceably in the nation of Israel through these lands of famine, these times of famine, and even further on in, later on down the road for years to come. He was the one responsible. He was the one who was able to ensure that his family survived. Not only that they survived, but that they thrived. And they were able to become very numerous and prosperous there as they lived in the land. Another additional point, I don't want to get too much into those stories because I want to get to some more of the meat of our stories with regard to Joseph. But I think it's important for us to mention here he was a husband to Aseneth, or however you want to say her name. She was an Egyptian. She was actually the daughter of On. On was a priest. I take it back. Not On is the place. She was the daughter of Potipharah. And he was a priest of the city of On. So she was from On. Her father was a priest. And that's pretty much all we know about her. She's not mentioned elsewhere besides as being the mother of Joseph's children. And, of course, that's going to be the next point here, that not only was he the husband of Aseneth, but he was also the father of Manasseh and Ephraim. And I don't want to go into too many voluminous details on Manasseh and Ephraim, but suffice it to say, these two tribes became two of the most prominent and two of the most important ones throughout the Hebrew history. In fact, Manasseh, or the half-tribe of Manasseh, as it's later called through a lot of scripture, because a lot of it was destroyed, it becomes a very important, almost a pawn with regard to the northern and southern kingdoms, with regard to the city of Jerusalem and that area, because the half-tribe of Manasseh occupied some of that territory around those areas, around where Judah was. Ephraim, on the other hand, was very important as well as we go through Hebrew history. If you have an electronic program or if you want to look in a concordance and look up the word Ephraim, you're going to see multitude and a volume of references in the Old Testament. Why? Because Ephraim becomes almost synonymous with the northern kingdom. Why is that? Well, part of it's because Jeroboam, when he first established the northern kingdom, built his capital city in the name in the city of Shechem, which was actually in Ephraim, the tribe of Ephraim. Now, later on, of course, it does move around and it does change. He puts up idols at different places. And so Shechem does not become as an important area, an important place. But if you read through, especially like Isaiah or in Psalms, when the nation, the word Ephraim or the tribe of Ephraim is mentioned, it almost becomes synonymous with the northern kingdom, especially in a lot of the words of Isaiah dealing with the kingdoms and the different things there. So Ephraim becomes a very important place. It's also the home to numerous different people throughout the Hebrew history. Some of them would be, let's see, I wrote a few of them down. Gideon became, Gideon's of Manasseh. I'm sorry, I'm getting them mixed up. Gideon is of Manasseh. Let's see, other important ones of Manasseh. I think that's it. Ephraim, though, is Joshua. Joshua, the city that he eventually chose to settle down in after the accomplishment of taking over Canaan's land again there and the inhabiting of Canaan by the Israelite nation. They gave him a city, and that city he chose was Timnath-Serah, and that was in the hill country of Ephraim. Likewise, Phinehas, the priest in Hebrew history, was given a town in Ephraim as well. Deborah, one of the women judges of Israel, actually had her outpost, so to speak, in Ephraim, in the hill countries of Ephraim, where people would come to her for her judgment. You see that in Judges chapter 4, verse 5. Elkanah, for those of you all who know the story of Samuel, Elkanah was from Ephraim. And so that's, you see the legacy that you have of this wonderful tribe and the many people that it was able to bring about, as I said, in prominence later on in the northern kingdom, after the kingdom was divided, after Solomon's reign. Ephraim was part of the northern kingdom and became one of the lead tribes there. And as I said, a lot of prophecies, a lot of the speaking in Hosea, Isaiah, and some other of the prophets speak about Ephraim as being representative of the entire northern kingdom. Doesn't actually call out Dan and Issachar and those other places. That actually just says Ephraim. And so you see the importance of these two individuals. But they were the sons of Joseph. And not only were they the sons of Joseph, they were the sons of promise, adopted by Jacob, as we talked about last week, as being the ones who gained the inheritance through Jacob as part of Joseph's portion, really. They kind of were substituted into Joseph's part and Joseph's part of the inheritance because Jacob wanted to doubly bless Joseph. And so this is kind of his mechanism and roundabout way of doing that without causing a further stink. He was also the governor of Egypt. I spoke about that a moment ago. In chapter 42, verse 6, Pharaoh, after having the interpretation of his dream by Joseph, said, okay, who, you know, Joseph said, you're going to find, you need to find somebody who's able to manage your land, manage all the people for these 7 years of plenty and of abundance, because you need to make sure that you have a storehouse built up for those 7 years of famine. And Pharaoh in chapter 42 kind of says, well, who am I supposed to do this with? Well, he kind of looks around, and right in front of him, of course, is Joseph, because he just interpreted his dream. He said, hey, I think you're the guy to do this. And so he appoints Joseph. He says there in chapter 42, he is second only to Pharaoh. And so he rode around the land of Egypt on a chariot, just like Pharaoh did, was able to go around and command things. If someone wanted grain to eat in those 7 years of famine, Pharaoh didn't deal with those things. He said, you go talk to Joseph. You go ask him for those provisions. And he's the one who actually made those decisions for Pharaoh, and instead of Pharaoh getting involved. So he was that second in command. He was that deputy Pharaoh, so to speak, there in that land. And he attained this. Why? Well, there's a couple of reasons. First of all, I think you see is because of God's hand. God allowed him to be in those places, in those circumstances, at those particular times to enjoy these blessings. He was the one who allowed him to interpret the dreams of the baker and the cupbearer in prison. Talk about that in a second as well. But that allowed him to be in the position of being remembered by the cupbearer and Pharaoh's court and called up to duty whenever Pharaoh couldn't get anyone else to interpret his dream. Pharaoh looked at Joseph as being someone who God was with, and whose God's hand was with in everything that he did. He prospered everywhere he went. And so God was able to help him do that. Also, I think secondly, it was just his service to Pharaoh and his ability to be able to do the things that were necessary to accomplish the goals. He wouldn't have stayed in office for all those times and for all these years if he wasn't doing a good job. Okay, so Joseph seems to be a diligent worker, and everything he did, it wasn't just that God was with him, but it's that Joseph exerted himself and did those things that were necessary to be successful on that personal level. He was the one that was able to do the hard work, that grunt work, so to speak, every single day in all those different jobs that he had, so that he would be looked upon as a hard worker and someone that people could count on. And I think that Pharaoh had to have acknowledged that. Now, we don't have specific reference of that in God's word, but he would not have been able to survive for all those many years as a lead governor of the land of Egypt had he not been good at his job. He would have been killed, probably. He would have been put to death because he wasn't doing his job properly. Definitely would have been demoted. But evidently, and we see the result of his hard work, the land of Egypt became so prosperous that they ended up having all this land and all this property, all this livestock, because of Joseph's foresight and his hard work and enabling Pharaoh to be able to be successful through not just the years of abundance, but those years of the famine that he was able to do. And also finally, real quickly, a final factoid about Joseph is that he was buried in Canaan's land. He was buried in Canaan. He did not want to be buried and remain in Egypt. Now, he remained there for many years. Don't get me wrong. He stayed there, and his bones stayed in Egypt for a long, long time period. Well, how do we know that? Well, because they stayed there all the way from his death, all the way until Moses and the people of Israel left those chains of bondage in Egypt. Well, exactly how long was that time period? Well, you can kind of guesstimate there, but it was a good long time period, several generations. In fact, it was enough generations that Exodus, the first chapter of Exodus, said that a Pharaoh arose that did not know Joseph. And so Joseph had been long gone before the people of Israel were enslaved and put into bondage. And of course, they were enslaved and put into bondage for many years. We know Moses especially was at least 40 to 60 years old. I can't remember exactly, and I haven't studied that again recently, but I know he spent many years after he fled Egyptians, after he killed that Egyptian and he fled to the hill country and then came back. So there's many, many years that you think about that Joseph's bones stayed in the land of Egypt. But what Joseph did not want is to stay there. He wanted to be a part of that land of promise. He had to have heard the stories from his grandfather, from his father, from his great-grandfather, and the promises made by God. And so when Joseph died, in Genesis chapter 50, he made his brothers and their families promise to him that they would carry him out of the land of Egypt to bury him. He wanted to be buried in the land of his fathers that had been promised to them, that had been promised to Abraham and to Isaac and to Jacob. He did not want to stay in Egypt. And so he made them promise to him that they would bring his bones up out of the land of Egypt. And that's indeed what happened. You see in Joshua chapter 24, verse 32, when the people of Israel finally prevailed, they finally buried his bones out of Egypt. They actually buried them in a land, I think it's Shechem is the name of the place that they buried him. And there they buried him in a place, I believe, that was given to Jacob, his father, before, and buried him there. So he was not buried. He did not stay in Egypt, but in fact went back up to Canaan land, sojourned with those people of Israel, with all of his brothers and their kindreds, and for all those many years, and then finally made it to the promised land. The story of Joseph's bones, I think, is very interesting when you think about it. These people of Israel wandered around for at least 40 years in the wilderness. They wandered around a little bit longer than that, too, to get there the first time around. But then they wandered an additional 40 years in the wilderness because of their disobedience and unfaithfulness to God. And during all that time period, Joseph's bones were with them. And finally, though, whenever they made it there, that's Joshua Chronicles there in Joshua chapter 24, his bones were buried and laid to rest finally. We'll pick up next week with the story of Joseph and talk about his faithfulness to God. Thank you.